and by how much time was spent on trying to manage their suicidal thoughts and self-destructive behaviors, rather than on understanding the possible causes of their despair and helplessness. I was also struck by how little attention was paid to their accomplishments and aspirations, whom they cared for, loved or hated, what motivated and engaged them, what kept them stuck, and what made them feel at peace, the ecology of their lives. A few years later, as a young doctor, I was confronted with an especially stark example of the medical model in action. I was then moonlighting at a Catholic hospital, doing physical examinations on women who'd been admitted to receive electroshock treatment for depression. Being my curious immigrant self, I looked up from the charts to ask them about their lives. Many of them spilled out stories of painful marriages, difficult children, and guilt over abortions. As they spoke, they visibly brightened and often thanked me effusively for listening to them. Some of them wondered if they really still needed electroshock after having gotten so much off their chests. I always felt sad at the end of these meetings, knowing that the treatments that would be administered the following morning would erase all memory of our conversation. I did not last long in that job. On my days off from the ward at MMHC, I often went to the Countway Library of Medicine to learn more about the patients I was supposed to help. One Saturday afternoon, I came across a treatise that is still revered today, Eugen Bleuler's 1911 textbook, Dementia Praecox. Bleuler's observations were fascinating. He wrote, "Among schizophrenic body hallucinations, the sexual ones are by far the most frequent and the most important. All the raptures and joys of normal and abnormal sexual satisfaction are experienced by these patients, but even more frequently, every obscene and disgusting practice which the most extravagant fantasy can conjure up. Male patients have their semen drawn off. Painful erections are stimulated. The women patients are raped and injured in the most devilish ways. In spite of the symbolic meaning of many such hallucinations, the majority of them correspond to real sensations." This made me wonder. Our patients had hallucinations. The doctors routinely asked about them and noted them as signs of how disturbed the patients were. But if the stories I'd heard in the wee hours were true, could it be that these hallucinations were in fact the fragmented memories of real experiences? Were hallucinations just the concoctions of sick brains? Could people make up physical sensations they had never experienced? Was there a clear line between creativity and pathological imagination, between memory and imagination? These questions remain unanswered to this day, but research has shown that people who've been abused as children often feel sensations, such as abdominal pain, that have no obvious physical cause. They hear voices warning of danger or accusing them of heinous crimes. There was no question that many patients on the ward engaged in violent, bizarre, and self-destructive behaviors, particularly when they felt frustrated, thwarted, or misunderstood. They threw temper tantrums, hurled plates, smashed windows, and cut themselves with shards of glass. At that time, I had no idea why someone might react to a simple request, such as, "Let me clean that goop out of your hair," with rage or terror. I usually followed the lead of the experienced nurses who signaled when to back off, or, if that did not work, to restrain a patient. I was surprised and alarmed by the satisfaction I sometimes felt after I'd wrestled a patient to the floor so a nurse could give an injection, and I gradually realized how much of our professional training was geared to helping us stay in control in the face of terrifying and confusing realities. Sylvia was a gorgeous 19-year-old Boston University student who usually sat alone in the corner of the ward, looking frightened to death and virtually mute, but whose reputation as the girlfriend of an important Boston mafioso gave her an aura of mystery. After she refused to eat for more than a week and rapidly started to lose weight, the doctors decided to force-feed her. It took three of us to hold her down, another to push the rubber feeding tube down her throat, and a nurse to pour the liquid nutrients into her stomach. Later, during a midnight confession, Sylvia spoke timidly and hesitantly about her childhood sexual abuse by her brother and uncle. I realized then our display of caring must have felt to her much like a gang rape. This experience, and others like it, helped me formulate this rule for my students. If you do something to a patient that you would not do to your friends or children, consider whether you are unwittingly replicating a trauma from a patient's past. In my role as recreation leader, I noticed other things. As a group, the patients were strikingly clumsy and physically uncoordinated. When we went camping, most of them stood helplessly by as I pitched the tents. We almost capsized once in a squall on the Charles River because they huddled rigidly in the lee, unable to grasp that they needed to shift position to balance the boat. In volleyball games, the staff members invariably were much better coordinated than the patients. Another characteristic they shared was that even their most relaxed conversations seemed stilted, lacking the natural flow of gestures and facial expressions that are typical among friends. The relevance of these observations became clear only after I'd met the body-based therapists Peter Levine and Pat Ogden. In the later chapters, I'll have a lot to say about how trauma is held in people's bodies. Making sense of suffering. After my year on the research ward, I resumed medical school and then, as a newly minted MD, returned to MMHC to be trained as a psychiatrist, a program to which I was thrilled to be accepted. Many famous psychiatrists had trained there, including Eric Kandel, who later won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. Alan Hobson discovered the brain cells responsible for the generation of dreams in a lab in the hospital basement while I trained there, and the first studies on the chemical underpinnings of depression were also conducted at MMHC. But for many of us residents, the greatest draw was the patients. We spent 6 hours each day with them, and then met as a group with senior psychiatrists to share our observations, pose our questions, and compete to make the wittiest remarks. Our great teacher, Elvin Semrad, actively discouraged us from reading psychiatry textbooks during our first year. This intellectual starvation diet may account for the fact that most of us later became voracious readers and prolific writers. Semrad did not want our perceptions of reality to become obscured by the pseudo-certainties of psychiatric diagnoses. I remember asking him once, "What would you call this patient? Schizophrenic or schizoaffective?" He paused and stroked his chin, apparently deep in thought. "I think I'd call him Michael McIntyre," he replied. Semrad taught us that most human suffering is related to love and loss, and that the job of therapists is to help people acknowledge, experience, and bear the reality of life with all its pleasures and heartbreak. "The greatest sources of our suffering are the lies we tell ourselves," he'd say, urging us to be honest with ourselves about every facet of our experience. He often said that people can never get better without knowing what they know and feeling what they feel. I remember being surprised to hear this distinguished old Harvard professor confess how comforted he was to feel his wife's bum against him as he fell asleep at night. By disclosing such simple human needs in himself, he helped us recognize how basic they were to our lives. Failure to attend to them results in a stunted existence, no matter how lofty our thoughts and worldly accomplishments. "Healing," he told us, "depends on experiential knowledge. You can be fully in charge of your life only if you can acknowledge the reality of your body in all its visceral dimensions." Our profession, however, was moving in a different direction. In 1968, the American Journal of Psychiatry had published the results of the study from the ward where I'd been an attendant. They showed unequivocally that schizophrenic patients who received drugs alone had a better outcome than those who talked 3 times a week with the best therapists in Boston. This study was one of many milestones on a road that gradually changed how medicine and psychiatry approached psychological problems. From infinitely variable expressions of intolerable feelings and relationships to a brain disease model of discrete disorders. The way medicine approaches human suffering has always been determined by the technology available at any given time. Before the Enlightenment, aberrations in behavior were ascribed to God, sin, magic, witches, and evil spirits. It was only in the 19th century that scientists in France and Germany began to investigate behavior as an adaptation to the complexities of the world. Now a new paradigm was emerging. Anger, lust, pride, greed, avarice, and sloth, as well as all the other problems we humans have always struggled to manage, were recast as disorders that could be fixed by the administration of appropriate chemicals. Many psychiatrists were relieved and delighted to become real scientists, just like their med school classmates, who had laboratories, animal experiments, expensive equipment, and complicated diagnostic tests, and set aside the woolly-headed theories of philosophers like Freud and Jung. A major textbook of psychiatry went so far as to state, "The cause of mental illness is now considered an aberration of the brain, a chemical imbalance." Like my colleagues, I eagerly embraced the pharmacological revolution. In 1973, I became the first chief resident in psychopharmacology at MMHC. I may also have been the first psychiatrist in Boston to administer lithium to a manic depressive patient. I'd read about John Cade's work with lithium in Australia, and I received permission from a hospital committee to try it. On lithium, a woman who had been manic every May for the past 35 years and suicidally depressed every November, stopped cycling and remained stable for the 3 years she was under my care. I was also part of the first U.S. research team to test the antipsychotic Clozaril on chronic patients who were warehoused in the back wards of the old insane asylums. Some of their responses were miraculous. People who had spent much of their lives locked in their own separate terrifying realities were now able to return to their families and communities. Patients mired in darkness and despair started to respond to the beauty of human contact and the pleasures of work and play. These amazing results made us optimistic that we could finally conquer human misery. Antipsychotic drugs were a major factor in reducing the number of people living in mental hospitals in the United States from over 500,000 in 1955 to fewer than 100,000 in 1996. For people today who did not know the world before the advent of these treatments, the change is almost unimaginable. As a first-year medical student, I visited Kankakee State Hospital in Illinois and saw a burly ward attendant hose down dozens of filthy, naked, incoherent patients in an unfurnished day room supplied with gutters for the runoff water. This memory now seems more like a nightmare than like something I witnessed with my own eyes. My first job after finishing my residency in 1974 was as the second-to-last director of a once venerable institution, the Boston State Hospital, which had formerly housed thousands of patients and been spread over hundreds of acres with dozens of buildings, including greenhouses, gardens, and workshops, most of them by then in ruins. During my time there, patients were gradually dispersed into the community, the blanket term for the anonymous shelters and nursing homes where most of them ended up. Ironically, the hospital was started as an asylum, a word meaning sanctuary, that gradually took on a sinister connotation. It actually did offer a sheltered community where everybody knew the patients' names and idiosyncrasies. In 1979, shortly after I went to work at the VA, the Boston State Hospital's gates were permanently locked, and it became a ghost town. During my time at Boston State, I continued to work at the MMHC Psychopharmacology Lab, which was now focusing on another direction for research. In the 1960s, scientists at the National Institutes of Health had begun to develop techniques for isolating and measuring hormones and neurotransmitters in blood and the brain. Neurotransmitters are chemical messengers that carry information from neuron to neuron, enabling us to engage effectively with the world. Now that scientists were finding evidence that abnormal levels of norepinephrine were associated with depression and of dopamine with schizophrenia, there was hope that we could develop drugs that target specific brain abnormalities. That hope was never fully realized, but our efforts to measure how drugs could affect mental symptoms led to another profound change in the profession. Researchers' need for a precise and systematic way to communicate their findings resulted in the development of the so-called research diagnostic criteria, to which I contributed as a lowly research assistant. These eventually became the basis for the first systematic system to diagnose psychiatric problems, the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, which is commonly referred to as the Bible of Psychiatry. The foreword to the landmark 1980 DSM-3 was appropriately modest and acknowledged that this diagnostic system was imprecise. So imprecise that it never should be used for forensic or insurance purposes. As we will see, that modesty was tragically short-lived. Inescapable shock. Preoccupied with so many lingering questions about traumatic stress, I became intrigued with the idea that the nascent field of neuroscience could provide some answers, and started to attend the meetings of the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology, the ACNP. In 1984, the ACNP offered many fascinating lectures about drug development. But it was not until a few hours before my scheduled flight back to Boston that I heard a presentation by Stephen Meyer of the University of Colorado, who had collaborated with Martin Seligman of the University of Pennsylvania. His topic was learned helplessness in animals. Meyer and Seligman had repeatedly administered painful electric shocks to dogs who were trapped in locked cages. They called this condition inescapable shock. Being a dog lover, I realized that I could never have done such research myself, but I was curious about how this cruelty would affect the animals. After administering several courses of electric shock, the researchers opened the doors of the cages and then shocked the dogs again. A group of control dogs who had never been shocked before immediately ran away, but the dogs, who had earlier been subjected to inescapable shock, made no attempt to flee, even when the door was wide open. They just lay there, whimpering and defecating. The mere opportunity to escape does not necessarily make traumatized animals or people take the road to freedom. Like Meyer and Seligman's dogs, many traumatized people simply give up. Rather than risk experimenting with new options, they stay stuck in the fear they know. I was riveted by Meyer's account. What they had done to these poor dogs was exactly what had happened to my traumatized human patients. They, too, had been exposed to somebody or something who had inflicted terrible harm on them, harm they had no way of escaping. I made a rapid mental review of the patients I had treated. Almost all had in some way been trapped or immobilized, unable to take action to stave off the inevitable. Their fight-flight response had been thwarted, and the result was either extreme agitation or collapse. Meyer and Seligman also found that traumatized dogs secrete much larger amounts of stress hormones than was normal. This supported what we were beginning to learn about the biological underpinnings of traumatic stress. A group of young researchers, among them Stephen Southwick and John Crystal at Yale, Ari Shalev at Hadassah Medical School in Jerusalem, Frank Putnam at the National Institute of Mental Health, the NIMH, and Roger Pittman, later at Harvard, were all finding that traumatized people keep secreting large amounts of stress hormones long after the actual danger has passed. And Rachel Yehuda at Mount Sinai in New York confronted us with her seemingly paradoxical findings that the levels of the stress hormone cortisol are low in PTSD. Her discoveries only started to make sense when her research clarified that cortisol puts an end to the stress response by sending an all-safe signal, and that in PTSD, the The body's stress hormones do, in fact, not return to baseline after the threat has passed. Ideally, our stress hormone system should provide a lightning-fast response to threat, but then quickly return us to equilibrium. In PTSD patients, however, the stress hormone system fails at this balancing act. Fight, flight, freeze signals continue after the danger is over, and as in the case of the dogs, do not return to normal. Instead, the continued secretion of stress hormones is expressed as agitation and panic, and in the long term, wreaks havoc with their health. I missed my plane that day because I had to talk with Steve Meyer. His workshop offered clues not only with the underlying problems of my patients, but also potential keys to their resolution. For example, he and Seligman had found that the only way to teach the traumatized dogs to get off the electric grids when the doors were open was to repeatedly drag them out of their cages so they could physically experience how they could get away. I wondered if we also could help my patients with their fundamental orientation that there was nothing they could do to defend themselves. Did my patients also need to have physical experiences to restore a visceral sense of control? What if they could be taught to physically move to escape a potentially threatening situation that was similar to the trauma in which they had been trapped and immobilized? As I will discuss in the treatment part of this book, that was one of the conclusions I eventually reached. Further animal studies involving mice, rats, cats, monkeys, and elephants brought more intriguing data. For example, when researchers played a loud, intrusive sound, mice that had been raised in a warm nest with plenty of food scurried home immediately. But another group, raised in a noisy nest with scarce food supplies, also ran for home, even after spending time in more pleasant surroundings. Scared animals return home, regardless of whether home is safe or frightening. I thought about my patients with abusive families who kept going back to be hurt again. Are traumatized people condemned to seek refuge in what is familiar? If so, why? And is it possible to help them become attached to places and activities that are safe and pleasurable? Addicted to trauma, the pain of pleasure, and the pleasure of pain. One of the things that struck my colleague Mark Greenberg and me when we ran therapy groups for Vietnam combat veterans was how, despite their feelings of horror and grief, many of them seemed to come to life when they talked about their helicopter crashes and their dying comrades. Former New York Times correspondent Chris Hedges, who covered a number of brutal conflicts, entitled his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Many traumatized people seem to seek out experiences that would repel most of us, and patients often complain about a vague sense of emptiness and boredom when they are not angry, under duress, or involved in some dangerous activity. My patient Julia was brutally raped at gunpoint in a hotel room at age 16. Shortly thereafter, she got involved with a violent pimp who prostituted her. He regularly beat her up. She was repeatedly jailed for prostitution, but she always went back to her pimp. Finally, her grandparents intervened and paid for an intense rehab program. After she successfully completed inpatient treatment, she started working as a receptionist and taking courses at a local college. In her sociology class, she wrote a term paper about the liberating possibilities of prostitution, for which she read the memoirs of several famous prostitutes. She gradually dropped all her other courses. A brief relationship with a classmate quickly went sour. He bored her to tears, she said, and she was repelled by his boxer shorts. She then picked up an addict on the subway who first beat her up and then started to stalk her. She finally became motivated to return to treatment when she was once again severely beaten. Freud had a term for such traumatic reenactments. He called them the compulsion to repeat. He and many of his followers believed that reenactments were an unconscious attempt to get control over a painful situation and that they eventually could lead to mastery and resolution. There is no evidence for that theory. Repetition leads only to further pain and self-hatred. In fact, even reliving the trauma repeatedly in therapy may reinforce preoccupation and fixation. Mark Greenberg and I decided to learn more about attractors, the things that draw us, motivate us, and make us feel alive. Normally, attractors are meant to make us feel better. So, why are so many people attracted to dangerous or painful situations? We eventually found a study that explained how activities that cause fear or pain can later become thrilling experiences. In the 1970s, Richard Solomon of the University of Pennsylvania had shown that the body learns to adjust to all sorts of stimuli. We may get hooked on recreational drugs because they right away make us feel so good, but activities like sauna bathing, marathon running, or parachute jumping, which initially cause discomfort and even terror, can ultimately become very enjoyable. This gradual adjustment signals that a new chemical balance has been established within the body, so that marathon runners, say, get a sense of well-being and exhilaration from pushing their bodies to the limit. At this point, just as with drug addiction, we start to crave the activity and experience withdrawal when it's not available. In the long run, people become more preoccupied with the pain of withdrawal than the activity itself. This theory could explain why some people hire someone to beat them, or burn them with cigarettes, or why they are only attracted to people who hurt them. Fear and aversion, in some perverse way, can be transformed into pleasure. Solomon hypothesized that endorphins, the morphine-like chemicals that the brain secretes in response to stress, play a role in the paradoxical addictions he described. I thought of his theory again when my library habit led me to a paper titled Pain in Men, Wounded in Battle, published in 1946. Having observed that 75% of severely wounded soldiers on the Italian front did not request morphine, a surgeon by the name of Henry K. Beecher speculated that strong emotions can block pain. Were Beecher's observations relevant to people with PTSD? Mark Greenberg, Roger Pittman, Scott Orr, and I decided to ask 8 Vietnam combat veterans if they would be willing to take a standard pain test while they watched scenes from a number of movies. The first clip we showed was from Oliver Stone's graphically violent Platoon, 1986, and while it ran, we measured how long the veterans could keep their right hands in a bucket of ice water. We then repeated this process with a peaceful and long-forgotten movie clip. 7 of the 8 veterans kept their hands in the painfully cold water 30% longer during Platoon. We then calculated that the amount of analgesia produced by watching 15 minutes of a combat movie was equivalent to that produced by being injected with 8 milligrams of morphine, about the same dose a person would receive in an emergency room for crushing chest pain. We concluded that Beecher's speculation that strong emotions can block pain was the result of the release of morphine-like substances manufactured in the brain. This suggested that for many traumatized people, re-exposure to stress might provide a similar relief from anxiety. It was an interesting experiment, but it did not fully explain why Julia kept going back to her violent pimp. Soothing the brain. The 1985 ACNP meeting was, if possible, even more thought-provoking than the previous year's session. King's College professor Jeffrey Gray gave a talk about the amygdala, a cluster of brain cells that determines whether a sound, image, or body sensation is perceived as a threat. Gray's data showed that the sensitivity of the amygdala depended, at least in part, on the amount of the neurotransmitter serotonin in that part of the brain. Animals with low serotonin levels were hyperreactive to stressful stimuli, like loud noises, while higher levels of serotonin dampened their fear system, making them less likely to become aggressive or frozen in response to potential threats. That struck me as an important finding. My patients were always blowing up in response to small provocations and felt devastated by the slightest rejection. I became fascinated by the possible role of serotonin in PTSD. Other researchers had shown that dominant male monkeys had much higher levels of brain serotonin than lower-ranking animals, but that their serotonin levels dropped when they were prevented from maintaining eye contact with the monkeys they had once lorded over. In contrast, low-ranking monkeys who were given serotonin supplements emerged from the pack to assume leadership. The social environment interacts with brain chemistry. Manipulating a monkey into a lower position in the dominance hierarchy made his serotonin drop, while chemically enhancing serotonin elevated the rank of former subordinates. The implications for traumatized people were obvious. Like Gray's low serotonin animals, they were hyperreactive, and their ability to cope socially was often compromised. If we could find ways to increase brain serotonin levels, perhaps we could address both problems simultaneously. At the same 1985 meeting, I learned that drug companies were developing two new products to do precisely that. But since neither was yet available, I experimented briefly with the health food store supplement L-tryptophan, which is a chemical precursor of serotonin in the body. The results were disappointing. One of the drugs under investigation never made it to market. The other was fluoxetine, which, under the brand name Prozac, became one of the most successful psychoactive drugs ever created. On Monday, February 8, 1988, Prozac was released by the drug company Eli Lilly. The first patient I saw that day was a young woman with an horrendous history of childhood abuse who was now struggling with bulimia. She basically spent much of her life binging and purging. I gave her a prescription for this brand new drug, and when she returned on Thursday, she said, "I've had a very different last few days. I ate when I was hungry, and the rest of the time I did my schoolwork." This was one of the most dramatic statements I had ever heard in my office. On Friday, I saw another patient to whom I had given Prozac the previous Monday. She was a chronically depressed mother of two school-aged children, preoccupied with their failures as a mother and wife and overwhelmed by demands from the parents who had badly mistreated her as a child. After 4 days on Prozac, she asked me if she could skip her appointment the following Monday, which was President's Day. "After all," she explained, "I've never taken my kids skiing. My husband always does, and they are off that day. It would really be nice for them to have some good memories of us having fun together." This was a patient who had always struggled merely to get through the day. After her appointment, I called someone I knew at Eli Lilly and said, "You have a drug that helps people to be in the present instead of being locked in the past." Lilly later gave me a small grant to study the effects of Prozac on PTSD in 64 people, 22 women and 42 men, the first study of the effects of this new class of drugs on PTSD. Our trauma clinic team enrolled 33 non-veterans, and my collaborators, former colleagues at the VA, enrolled 31 combat veterans. For 8 weeks, half of each group received Prozac and the other half a placebo. The study was blinded. Neither we nor the patients knew which substance they were taking, so that our preconceptions could not skew our assessments. Everyone in the study, even those who had received the placebo, improved, at least to some degree. Most treatment studies of PTSD find a significant placebo effect. People who screw up their courage to participate in a study for which they aren't paid, in which they're repeatedly poked with needles, and in which they have only a 50-50 chance of getting an active drug, are intrinsically motivated to solve their problem. Maybe their reward is only the attention paid to them, the opportunity to respond to questions about how they feel and think. But maybe the mother's kisses that soothe her child's scrapes are just a placebo as well. Prozac worked significantly better than the placebo for the patients from the trauma clinic. They slept more soundly, they had more control over their emotions, and were less preoccupied with the past than those who received a sugar pill. Surprisingly, however, the Prozac had no effect at all on the combat veterans at the VA. Their PTSD symptoms were unchanged. These results have held true for most subsequent pharmacological studies on veterans. While a few have shown modest improvements, most have not benefited at all. I have never been able to explain this, and I cannot accept the most common explanation, which is receiving a pension or disability benefits prevents people from getting better. After all, the amygdala knows nothing of pensions. It just detects threats. Nonetheless, medications such as Prozac and related drugs like Zoloft, Celexa, Cymbalta, and Paxil have made a substantial contribution to the treatment of trauma-related disorders. In our Prozac study, we used the Rorschach test to measure how traumatized people perceive their surroundings. These data gave us an important clue to how this class of drugs, formerly known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, might work. Before taking Prozac, these patients' emotions controlled their reactions. I think of a Dutch patient, for example, not in the Prozac study, who came to see me for treatment for a childhood rape, and who was convinced that I would rape her as soon as she heard my Dutch accent. Prozac made a radical difference. It gave PTSD patients a sense of perspective and helped them to gain considerable control over their impulses. Jeffrey Gray must have been right. When their serotonin levels rose, many of my patients became less reactive. The triumph of pharmacology. It did not take long for pharmacology to revolutionize psychiatry. Drugs gave doctors a greater sense of efficacy and provided a tool beyond talk therapy. Drugs also produced income and profits. Grants from the pharmaceutical industry provided us with laboratories filled with energetic graduate students and sophisticated instruments. Psychiatry departments, which had always been located in the basements of hospitals, started to move up, both in terms of location and prestige. One symbol of this change occurred at MMHC, where in the early 1990s the hospital's swimming pool was paved over to make space for a laboratory, and the indoor basketball court was carved up into cubicles for the new medication clinic. For decades, doctors and patients had democratically shared the pleasures of splashing in the pool and passing balls down the court. I'd spent hours in the gym with patients back when I was a ward attendant. It was the one place where we could all restore a sense of physical well-being, an island in the midst of the misery we faced every day. Now, it had become a place for patients to get fixed. The drug revolution that started out with so much promise may in the end have done as much harm as good. The theory that mental illness is caused primarily by chemical imbalances in the brain that can be corrected by specific drugs has become broadly accepted by the media and the public as well as by the medical profession. In many places, drugs have displaced therapy and enabled patients to suppress their problems without addressing the underlying issues. Antidepressants can make all the difference in the world in helping with day-to-day functioning, and if it comes to a choice between taking a sleeping pill and drinking yourself into a stupor every night to get a few hours of sleep, there is no question which is preferable. For people who are exhausted from trying to make it on their own through yoga classes, workout routines, or simply toughing it out, medications often can bring life-saving relief. The SSRIs can be very helpful in making traumatized people less enslaved by their emotions, but they should only be considered adjuncts in their overall treatment. After conducting numerous studies of medications for PTSD, I've come to realize that psychiatric medications have a serious downside, as they may deflect attention from dealing with the underlying issues. The brain disease model takes control over people's fate out of their own hands and puts doctors and insurance companies in charge of fixing their problems. Over the past 3 decades, psychiatric medications have become a mainstay in our culture, with dubious consequences. Consider the case of antidepressants. If they were indeed as effective as we have been led to believe, depression should by now have become a minor issue in our society. Instead, even as antidepressant use continues to increase, it has not made a dent in hospital admissions for depression. The number of people treated for depression has tripled over the past 2 decades, and 1 in 10 Americans now take antidepressants. The new generation of antipsychotics such as Abilify, Risperdal, Zyprexa, and Seroquel are the top-selling drugs in the United States. In 2012, the public spent $1,526,228,000 on Abilify, more than on any other medication. Number 3 was Cymbalta, an antidepressant that sold well over $1 billion worth of pills, even though it has never been shown to be superior to older antidepressants like Prozac, for which much cheaper generics are available. Medicaid, the government health program for the poor, spends more on antipsychotics than on any other class of drugs. In 2008, the most recent year for which complete data are available, it funded $3.6 billion for antipsychotic medications, up from $1.65 billion in 1999. The number of people under the age of 20 receiving Medicaid-funded prescriptions for antipsychotic drugs tripled between 1999 and 2008. On November 4, 2013, Johnson & Johnson agreed to pay more than $2.2 billion in criminal and civil fines to settle accusations that it had improperly promoted the antipsychotic drug Risperdal to older adults, children, and people with developmental disabilities. But nobody is holding the doctors who prescribed them accountable. 500,000 children in the United States currently take antipsychotic drugs. Children from low-income families are 4 times as likely as privately insured children to receive antipsychotic medications. These medications often are used to make abused and neglected children more tractable. In 2008, 19,045 children under age 5 and under were prescribed antipsychotics through Medicaid. One study, based on Medicaid data in 13 states, found that 12.4% of children in foster care received antipsychotics, compared with 1.4% of Medicaid-eligible children in general. These medications make children more manageable and less aggressive, but they also interfere with motivation, play, and curiosity, which are indispensable for maturing into a well-functioning and contributing member of society. Children who take them are also at risk of becoming morbidly obese and developing diabetes. Meanwhile, drug overdoses involving a combination of psychiatric and pain medications continue to rise. Because drugs have become so profitable, major medical journals rarely publish studies on non-drug treatments of mental health problems. Practitioners who explore treatments are typically marginalized as alternative. Studies of non-drug treatments are rarely funded unless they involve so-called manualized protocols, where patients and therapists go through narrowly prescribed sequences that allow little fine-tuning to individual patients' needs. Mainstream medicine is firmly committed to a better life through chemistry, and the fact that we can actually change our own physiology and inner equilibrium by means other than drugs is rarely considered. Adaptation or disease? The brain disease model overlooks 4 fundamental truths. 1, our capacity to destroy one another is matched by our capacity to heal one another. Restoring relationships and community is central to restoring well-being. 2, language gives us the power to change ourselves and others by communicating our experiences, helping us to define what we know and finding a common sense of meaning. 3, we have the ability to regulate our own physiology, including some of the so-called involuntary functions of the body and brain, through such basic activities as breathing, moving, and touching. And 4, we can change social conditions to create environments in which children and adults can feel safe and where they can thrive. When we ignore these quintessential dimensions of humanity, we deprive people of ways to heal from trauma and restore their autonomy. Being a patient, rather than a participant in one's healing process, separates suffering people from their community and alienates them from an inner sense of self. Given the limitations of drugs, I started to wonder if we could find more natural ways to help people deal with their post-traumatic responses. Chapter 3. Looking into the Brain. The Neuroscience Revolution. If we could look through the skull into the brain of a consciously thinking person, and if the place of optimal excitability were luminous, then we should see playing over the cerebral surface a bright spot with fantastic, waving borders, constantly fluctuating in size and form, and surrounded by darkness, more or less deep, covering the rest of the hemisphere. Ivan Pavlov. You observe a lot by watching. Yogi Berra. In the early 1990s, novel brain imaging techniques opened up undreamed-of capacities to gain a sophisticated understanding about the way the brain processes information. Gigantic multi-million-dollar machines based on advanced physics and computer technology rapidly made neuroscience into one of the most popular areas for research. Positron emission tomography, known as PET, and later functional magnetic resonance imaging, known as fMRI, enabled scientists to visualize how different parts of the brain are activated when people are engaged in certain tasks or when they remember events from the past. For the first time, we could watch the brain as it processed memories, sensations, and emotions, and began to map the circuits of mind and consciousness. The earlier technology of measuring brain chemicals like serotonin or norepinephrine had enabled scientists to look at what fueled neural activity, which is a bit like trying to understand a car's engine by studying gasoline. Neuroimaging made it possible to see inside the engine. By doing so, it has also transformed our understanding of trauma. Harvard Medical School was and is at the forefront of the neuroscience revolution, and in 1994, a young psychiatrist, Scott Rauch, was appointed as the first director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Neuroimaging Laboratory. After considering the most relevant questions that this new technology could answer and reading some articles I had written, Scott asked me whether I thought we could study what happens in the brains of people who have flashbacks. I had just finished a study on how trauma is remembered, which I'll be talking about in Chapter 12, in which participants repeatedly told me how upsetting it was to be suddenly hijacked by images, feelings, and sounds from the past. When several said they wished they knew what trick their brains were playing on them during these flashbacks, I asked 8 of them if they would be willing to return to the clinic and lie still inside a scanner, an entirely new experience that I described in detail, while we recreated a scene from the painful events that haunted them. To my surprise, all 8 agreed, many of them expressing their hope that what we learned from their suffering could help other people. My research assistant, Rita Fissler, who was working with us prior to entering Harvard Medical School, sat down with every participant and carefully constructed a script that recreated their trauma moment by moment. We deliberately tried to collect just isolated fragments of their experience, particular images, sounds, and feelings, rather than the entire story, because that is how trauma is experienced. Rita also asked the participants to describe a scene where they felt safe and in control. One person described her morning routine, another sitting on the porch of a farmhouse in Vermont overlooking the hills. We would use this script for a second scan to provide a baseline measurement. After the participants checked the scripts for accuracy, reading silently, which is less overwhelming than hearing or speaking, Rita made a voice recording that would be played back to them while they were in the scanner. Here's a typical script. You are 6 years old and getting ready for bed. You hear your mother and father yelling at each other. You are frightened, and your stomach is in a knot. You and your younger brother and sister are huddled at the top of the stairs. You look over the banister and see your father holding your mother's arms while she struggles to free herself. Your mother is crying, spitting and hissing like an animal. Your face is flushed, and you feel hot all over. When your mother frees herself, she runs to the dining room and breaks a very expensive Chinese vase. You yell at your parents to stop, but they ignore you. Your mom runs upstairs, and you hear her breaking the TV. Your little brother and sister try to get her to hide in the closet. Your heart pounds, and you are trembling. At this first session, we explained the purpose of the radioactive oxygen the participants would be breathing. As any part of the brain became more or less metabolically active, its rate of oxygen consumption would immediately change, which would be picked up by the scanner. We would monitor their blood pressure and heart rate throughout the procedure, so that these physiological signs could be compared with brain activity. Several days later, the participants came to the imaging lab. Marcia, a 40-year-old school teacher from a suburb outside of Boston, was the first volunteer to be scanned. Her script took her back to the day, 13 years earlier, when she picked up her 5-year-old daughter, Melissa, from day camp. As they drove off, Marcia heard a persistent beeping, indicating that Melissa's seatbelt was not properly fastened. When Marcia reached over to adjust the belt, she ran a red light. Another car smashed into hers from the right, instantly killing her daughter. In the ambulance on the way to the emergency room, the 7-month-old fetus Marcia was carrying also died. Overnight, Marcia had changed from a cheerful woman who was the life of the party into a haunted and depressed person filled with self-blame. She moved from classroom teaching into school administration because working directly with children had become intolerable. As for many parents who have lost children, their happy laughter had become a painful trigger. Even hiding behind her paperwork, she could barely make it through the day. In a futile attempt to keep her feelings at bay, she coped by working day and night. I was standing outside the scanner as Marcia underwent the procedure and could follow her physiological reactions on a monitor. The moment we turned on the tape recorder, her heart started to race and her blood pressure jumped. Simply hearing the script activated the same physiological responses that had occurred during the accident 13 years earlier. After the recorded script concluded, and Marcia's heart rate and blood pressure returned to normal, we played her second script, getting out of bed and brushing her teeth. This time, her heart rate and blood pressure did not change. As she emerged from the scanner, Marcia looked defeated, drawn out and frozen. Her breathing was shallow, her eyes were wide open, and her shoulders were hunched, the very image of vulnerability and defenselessness. We tried to comfort her, but I wondered if whatever we discovered would be worth the price of her distress. After all 8 participants completed the procedure, Scott Rauch went to work with his mathematicians and statisticians to create composite images that compared the arousal created by a flashback with the brain in neutral. After a few weeks, he sent me the results. I taped the scans up on the refrigerator in my kitchen, and for the next few months, I stared at them every evening. It occurred to me that this was how early astronomers must have felt when they peered through a telescope at a new constellation. There were some puzzling dots and colors on the scan, but the biggest area of brain activation, a large red spot in the right lower center of the brain, which is the limbic area, or emotional brain, came as no surprise. It was already well known that intense emotions activate the limbic system, in particular an area within it called the amygdala. We depend on the amygdala to warn us of impending danger and to activate the body's stress response. Our study clearly showed that when traumatized people are presented with images, sounds, or thoughts related to their particular experience, the amygdala reacts with alarm, even as in Marcia's case, 13 years after the event. Activation of this fear center triggers the cascade of stress hormones and nerve impulses that drive up blood pressure, heart rate, and oxygen intake, preparing the body for fight or flight. The monitors attached to Marcia's arms recorded this physiological state of frantic arousal, even though she never totally lost track of the fact that she was resting quietly in the scanner. Speechless horror. Our most surprising finding was a white spot in the left frontal lobe of the cortex, in a region called Broca's area. In this case, the change in color meant that there was a significant decrease in that part of the brain. Broca's area is one of the speech centers of the brain, which is often affected in stroke patients when the blood supply to that region is cut off. Without a functioning Broca's area, you cannot put your thoughts and feelings into words. Our scans showed that Broca's area went offline whenever a flashback was triggered. In other words, we have visual proof that the effects of trauma are not necessarily different from, and can overlap with, the effects of physical lesions like strokes. All trauma is proverbial. Shakespeare captures this state of speechless terror in Macbeth after the murdered king's body is discovered. Oh, horror, horror, horror! Tongue nor heart cannot conceive nor name thee. Confusion now hath made his masterpiece. Under extreme conditions, people may scream obscenities, call for their mothers, howl in terror, or simply shut down. Victims of assaults and accidents sit mute and frozen in emergency rooms. Traumatized children lose their tongues and refuse to speak. Photographs of combat soldiers show hollow-eyed men staring mutely into a void. Even years later, traumatized people often have enormous difficulty telling other people what has happened to them. Their bodies re-experience terror, rage, and helplessness, as well as the impulse to fight or flee, but these feelings are almost impossible to articulate. Trauma, by nature, drives us to the edge of comprehension, cutting us off from language based on common experience, or an imaginable past. This doesn't mean that people can't talk about a tragedy that has befallen them. Sooner or later, most survivors, like the veterans in Chapter 1, come up with what many of them call their cover story that offers some explanation for their symptoms and behavior for public consumption. These stories, however, rarely capture the inner truth of the experience. It is enormously difficult to organize one's traumatic experiences into a coherent account, a narrative with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Even a seasoned reporter, like the famed CBS correspondent Ed Murrow, struggled to convey the atrocities he saw when the Nazi concentration camp Buchenwald was liberated in 1945. He said, "I pray you believe what I have said. I reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words." When words fail, haunting images capture the experience and return as nightmares and flashbacks. In contrast to the deactivation of Broca's area, another region, Brodmann's Area 19, lit up in our participants. This is a region in the visual cortex that registers images when they first enter the brain. We were surprised to see brain activation in this area so long after the original experience of the trauma. Under ordinary conditions, raw images registered in Area 19 are rapidly diffused to other brain areas that interpret the meaning of what has been seen. Once again, we were witnessing a brain region rekindled as if the trauma were actually occurring. As we will see in Chapter 12, which discusses memory, other unprocessed sense fragments of trauma, like sounds and smells and physical sensations, are also registered separately from the story itself. Similar sensations often trigger a flashback that brings them back into consciousness, apparently unmodified by the passage of time. Shifting to one side of the brain. The scans also revealed that during flashbacks, our subjects' brains lit up only on the right side. Today, there's a huge body of scientific and popular literature about the difference between the right and left brains. Back in the early 90s, I had heard some people had begun to divide the world between left-brainers, meaning rational, logical people, and right-brainers, the intuitive, artistic ones. But I hadn't paid much attention to this idea. However, our scans clearly show